There's a huge conservation project that I've just discovered about a month ago that I probably can't afford. The time frame on this is 100 years at least. And I'm thinking, oh my God, if I went and bought this timber operation and let that land heal and restored it, 100 years from that day, it's going to be one of the most breathtakingly beautiful places. This is where God would have spoken to Adam. It has to be the Garden of Eden. And I'm thinking, okay, I can't afford it, but I really want to do it. I better go out there and work my ass off because it will be the best contribution I can make to someone 100 years from now. They won't know who did it, but they'll love that spot and they'll be so happy. Tony. Thank you, Paul. I love you, brother. Chapter 6.6. Ray Dalio, A Man for All Seasons. Founder and Co-Chief Investment Officer, Bridgewater Associates. Ray Dalio has been part of the DNA of this book from the moment I first sat down to interview him at his Connecticut home. Our initial meeting went on for nearly 3 hours of pitching and catching ideas about everything from the benefits of meditation, it gives me equanimity, said Ray, to the workings of the economy. It's a simple machine. I already knew the astounding track record of his $160 billion hedge fund, Bridgewater Associates, the biggest in the world. I knew that Ray manages risk better than anyone else on the planet, and that he's the go-to guy for world leaders and huge financial institutions when they need a safe harbor in the volatile marketplace. But I had no idea that when I asked him the same question that I asked every financial superstar in this book, what portfolio would you leave your children if you couldn't leave them money, that Ray's answer would turn out to be the holy grail I was seeking when I first began this quest. What was it? Nothing less than an investment plan for individual investors like you to grow your nest egg that would work in all seasons and without risking your life savings. Until now, only Ray Dalio's clients had access to his magic formula for investing success in every season. His generosity in choosing this time and place for sharing it with the world leaves me astonished and grateful. I don't need to go into Ray's background here. You've been on this journey with him from the first chapter in this book, and you've gotten this far. You've already listened to chapters 5.1 and 5.2, Invincible, Unsinkable, Unconquerable, the All-Season Strategy, and It's Time to Thrive, Storm-Proof Returns and Unrivaled Results, which tell his story and lay out the basis for his entire portfolio. I was going to list it here, but it's not as powerful without the context. If you jumped ahead, don't cheat. Go back and listen to his chapters. It will blow your mind and change your life. If you've heard them already, it's time to implement. Ray Dalio is the master of all seasons. Chapter 6.7. Mary Callahan Erdos, The Trillion Dollar Woman. CEO, J.P. Morgan Asset Management Division. Mary Callahan Erdos may only be 5'2", but she casts a long shadow as CEO of one of the largest asset management groups in the world at the biggest bank in the United States. Forbes magazine called her the rare female comet in the male-dominated firmament of Wall Street and listed her among the 100 most powerful women in the world. Since 2009, when she took over J.P. Morgan Chase's asset management division, it's grown by more than half a trillion, with a T, dollars, more than a 30% increase. Today, Erdos oversees the management of $2.5 trillion invested by foundations, central banks, pension funds, and some of the world's wealthiest individuals. She's often mentioned in the media as being on the short list to succeed J.P. Morgan Chase CEO, Jamie Dimon. While most of the voices in this book advocate that passive, low-fee money management brings the best results for individual investors over time, Erdos makes a case that funds that are actively managed by the best minds in the business are worth the fees they charge. She says the proof is in the loyalty of their satisfied clients, as well as the new business they continue to attract. Money management is in Erdos' blood. She was the firstborn child and only girl in a large Irish Catholic family in Winnetka, Illinois. Her father, Patrick Callahan, was an investment banker with Lazard Frere in Chicago. Mary excelled at math in high school while also winning equestrian medals, and went on to become the only female math major in her class at Georgetown University. She met her husband, Philip Erdos, while they were both earning MBAs at Harvard Business School. As a financial services executive, Erdos has broken the mold in more ways than one. In a business famous for aggressive management, her colleagues describe her style with words such as loyal, team-oriented, and caring. When she was coming up at J.P. Morgan, she was known for flying across the country to meet with clients who needed extra help in managing their assets. Now 47 years old and part of the highest level of management in a firm with 260,000 employees, she is honored as much for her extraordinary leadership as her financial brilliance. Our meeting took place at J.P. Morgan's world headquarters in the classic Union Carbide building overlooking Park Avenue and the skyscrapers of Manhattan. As I rode the elevator to the conference room, J.P. Morgan Asset Management's communications director, Darren Oduyoye, told me a story that touched me deeply and illustrated the kind of person I was about to meet. Oduyoye had always wanted to be a broadcaster, but took a job in J.P. Morgan's mutual fund division before transferring to public relations. When Erdos asked him to be a producer of a daily morning meeting broadcast for wealth management employees all over the world, he was shocked. "I don't know enough about investing," he objected. "Well, you told me you always wanted to be in broadcasting," she said. "Now you get to be a talk show producer." She saw more in me than I saw in myself, Darren told me. It doesn't matter what they do for the company. Erdos goes out of her way to know each of her employees. But she still carves out the time periodically to have lunch with her three young daughters and pick them up from school most days. That's the way she rolls, and it makes her the extraordinary leader and human being that she is. Tony Robbins, you lead one of the largest management groups in the world. Tell me a little about your journey, the challenges you faced, and the principles that guide you. Mary Callahan Erdos, I don't think you can lay out a path in life to get exactly where you want to go. A lot of it happens by accident or circumstance. I remember when I was given my first stock, Union Carbide. It was a birthday gift from my grandmother. I think I was 7 or 8, old enough to remember and young enough not to know what to do with it. The first thing she told me was, "You don't sell this." I'm not sure if I agree with that now, but she said, "This is the value of compounding. If you keep this, it will hopefully grow over time, and you will have something much larger." That also ingrained in me, at an early age, the importance of saving and started me thinking about money management. I already knew I had a knack for numbers, so the concept of saving versus spending was a powerful one for me. It helped that my father worked in the industry, and I spent a lot of weekends with him at work playing office. I sat in his desk, and I had my brothers in his assistant's desk. We had good fun growing up, and I think that showed me how interesting and exciting financial services could be, and that it wasn't something to be fearful of. That was very helpful early in life. Tony, you live in a business that has been dominated by men. What were some of the biggest challenges that you faced along the way? Mary, money management is an industry where results speak for themselves. It's a virtuous cycle. If you perform for your clients, they'll invest more money with you, and their money will make money. Again, the idea of compounding that I learned from my grandmother. So because of the focus on performance, money management is a business that fosters equality. If you perform, you will succeed. Tony, what's leadership? How do you define it? Mary, it's important not to confuse management with leadership. For me, leadership means not asking anyone to do anything I wouldn't do myself. It's waking up every morning trying to make your organization a better place. I truly believe that I work for the people of J.P. Morgan Asset Management, not the other way around. And because of that, I try to see beyond what people even see themselves. Having been a portfolio manager, client advisor, and business leader, I know what we're capable of achieving for our clients. So I consider it my job not just to lead our teams, but to get in the trenches alongside them and join them on the journey. I think in many ways, you're either born with leadership or not, but that doesn't mean you're not constantly working at it, honing it, and figuring out what works and what doesn't. The style of leadership will change with different people or different situations, but the basic tenets of leadership are consistent. Tony, I recently interviewed Dr. Robert Shiller, who just won the Nobel Prize in Economics, and he was talking all about the good that financial institutions do in the world that people take for granted. Why do you think their reputations have shifted, and what can be done to turn it around? Mary, following the financial crisis, it's easy to understand why some people lost trust in the industry. In hindsight, there were some things that needed to change, products that were too complex or confusing. But overall, the financial services industry contributes a lot to the world. We provide companies with capital to grow, which ultimately fuels employment. We help individuals save and invest their hard-earned money so they can do things like buy a house, pay for college, or retire more comfortably. We support local communities both financially and through the intellectual and physical capital of our people. I'm incredibly proud to be part of the industry, and even prouder to be part of J.P. Morgan. We have 260,000 people who work hard for clients every day and always strive to do the right thing. We have a saying that if you wouldn't let your grandmother buy a product, then it's probably not a business we should be in. It's a simplistic yet important way to look at things. Tony, it's a sensitive issue, I'm sure, but if you listen to Ray Dalio, you listen to Jack Bogle, David Swensen, Warren Buffett, they all say active management doesn't work over the long term. That 96% of active managers don't beat the index. I wanted to get your view on it because your performance has been extraordinary. Mary, one of the biggest challenges about successful investing is there's no such thing as a one-size-fits-all approach. But if you look at the world's most successful portfolio managers, you'll find that many of them manage money actively, buying and selling companies in which they think that they have added insight. Their track records have proven that active management, compounded over long periods of time, makes a very large difference in your portfolio. What an active manager can do is look at two seemingly similar companies and make a judgment based on extensive research about which is the better long-term investment. We've surrounded ourselves at J.P. Morgan Asset Management with managers who have done that successfully for a sustained period of time, and that's why we have $2.5 trillion of assets that people ask us to help them manage. Tony, great investors are invariably looking for asymmetric risk/reward, right? And the ultra-wealthy have always done this. But tell me, how does the average investor today get wealth without risk, or at least wealth with little risk, if they're not already ultra-wealthy? Mary, it is not about a wealth level. It's about being well-rounded, well-advised, and sticking to a plan. What happens too often is people start with a diversified plan, but as market conditions change, they try to time the market so they are getting either more upside opportunities or better protection in unfavorable conditions. But that's a very dangerous thing to do because it's impossible to predict every scenario. What a well-diversified portfolio does is help you capture those tail risks, risks that can bring great rewards. And if you stick to that plan, you can create a tremendous amount of wealth over the long term. Tony, what are some of the biggest opportunities for investors today and the largest challenges that they need to prepare for? Mary, I think that we will look back at the time that we're living in right now saying, that was a great time to have invested. We have so much liquidity in the system to take care of a lot of the things that went wrong. But investing over the next 5 years, particularly those with long-term growth prospects, are opportunities to consider right now. Most investors today want income, tempered volatility, and liquidity. There's still the hangover effects of 2008 where many are concerned about, if I need my money right away, can I get it? If you don't need it right away, get it invested. It will serve you very well over the coming years, and you will look back and be incredibly thankful that you did it. In addition, the industry has made a lot of changes in rules and regulations to attempt to ensure better conditions for the future. That's not to say there won't be market anomalies, but the system is better, and so it should be safer. Tony, I've asked this of every multi-billionaire that I've spoken with who started with nothing. Does financial stress ever go away for you? Mary, financial stress never goes away for people regardless of the level of their wealth or success. Tony, why is that? Mary, because no matter what stage you're in, you want to make sure you are using your money most effectively, whether that's paying for health care and your family's well-being, or ensuring you are investing your money properly for future generations or to fulfill philanthropic goals. Tony, is there an antidote to that stress? What is it for you? Mary. For me, it's all about keeping things in perspective and focusing on the things you can control, like ensuring that you're doing as much as you can every day and giving it your all. You can never be out of balance in taking care of yourself as a person, taking care of your work as a professional, taking care of your family, taking care of your friends, your mind, your body. It's okay for things to get out of whack every once in a while, but they can't stay out of whack. Tony, if all you could pass on to your children was a set of rules and/or a portfolio strategy or an asset allocation strategy, what would it be? Mary, invest for the long term and only take money out when you truly need it. Specific portfolio construction will be different for different people. For example, I have three daughters. They're three different ages. They have three different skill sets that will change over time. One might spend more money than another. One might be more frugal. One may want to work in an environment where she can earn a lot of money. Another may be more philanthropic in nature. One may get married, one may not. One may have children, one may not. So they'll have different dependents. Every single permutation will vary over time, which is why even if I started all of them on the first day they were born and set out an asset allocation, it would have to change. Tony, how old are your girls? Mary, 11, 10, and 7. They're lots of fun. Tony, from my understanding of what I've read, you believe in work-life integration. Tell me a little bit about that. Mary, I have the great fortune of working at a company that is very supportive of families and gives people a lot of flexibility to do what works best for them. So whether that means logging off a little early to catch your child's soccer game but then reconnecting later in the evening to finish a project, or bringing the kids to the office on the weekends like my dad used to do with me, you have the option to do what's best for you and your family. Tony, like you did at your father's office and they're sitting behind your desk preparing for the future. Mary, exactly. My work life and my family life are all one thing, and I'm always determined to get the most out of both of them. Chapter 6.8. T. Boone Pickens. Made to be rich, made to give. Chairman and CEO of BP Capital Management. T. Boone Pickens, dubbed the Oil Oracle by CNBC, has always been ahead of his time. In the early 1980s, he was the original corporate raider, although shareholder activist has always been the term he's preferred. His early focus on maximizing shareholder value, virtually unheard of at the time, has long since become a standard of American corporate culture. As Fortune magazine declared, Boone's once revolutionary ideas are so completely taken for granted that they have become linchpins of the economy. By the early 2000s, Pickens became a hedge fund manager, making his first billion after turning 70, with a second career investing in energy assets. In the next decade and a half, he'd turn that billion into $4 billion, $2 billion of which he'd lose again, and $1 billion of which he'd give away. Ever the optimist, Boone recently married for the fifth time, and at 86, he's got a huge social media presence and shows no signs of slowing down. After falling off the Forbes 400 list last year, he sent a famous tweet declaring, "Don't worry, at $950 million I'm doing fine. Funny, my $1 billion charitable giving exceeds my net worth." When I spoke to him regarding his net worth, he said, "Tony, you know me. I'm going to get the other $2 billion back in the next couple of years." Boone, a Depression-era baby, started with nothing. At 12, he delivered papers and quickly expanded his route from 28 to 156 papers, later citing his boyhood job as an early introduction to growing by acquisition. After graduating from Oklahoma State University, then known as Oklahoma A&M, in 1951 with a degree in geology, Pickens built an energy empire in Texas. By 1981, his Mesa Petroleum Corporation had become one of the largest independent oil companies in the world. His corporate takeovers of the 1980s were the stuff of legend, with Gulf Oil, Phillips Petroleum, and Unocal being some of his most famous takeover targets. But Pickens' fortunes and fortune were always shifting. When he left Mesa in 1996 after a downward spiral in the company's profits, many counted him out. He would soon lose 90% of his investing capital. But Pickens went on to stage one of the greatest comebacks in his industry, turning his investment fund's last $3 million into billions. While almost everyone we hear from these days is focused on primarily two asset classes, stocks and bonds, Boone's BP Capital Fund is different. He's betting on the direction of the energy futures and derivatives markets. And while this book is devoted to helping you achieve financial independence, Boone says our dependence on foreign oil is the single greatest threat not only to national security, but also to our economic well-being. Always one to be ahead of the curve, Boone is on a crusade today to free this country from our dependence on OPEC oil and usher in a new wave of energy policy with his Pickens plan. I've been a fan of Boone's for as long as I can remember, and now I'm privileged to call him a friend. He's been gracious enough to speak at many of my wealth events. What follows is an excerpt of our latest conversations around building wealth, protecting America's energy future, and his humble beginnings. Tony Robbins, the first thing I have to start with is the incredible story of your birth. You often say you're the luckiest guy in the world, and you really mean it. Tell me about that. T. Boone Pickens, my mom got pregnant in 1927, and I showed up in May 1928 in a small town in rural Oklahoma. And the doctor said to my father, Tom, you're going to have to make a tough decision here, whether your wife or your child survives. And my dad said, you can't do that. Surely you can figure out how to get the baby without losing either one of them. And the lucky thing was that of two doctors in that small town, my mom's doctor was a surgeon. And he said, well, Tom, what you're asking me to do is a cesarean section. I've never done it. I've seen it. I've read about it, and I'll show you how much that I've read. So he took him across the room and showed him a page and a half he had on cesarean section. Tom, this is all I have to go on, he said. My dad read it and looked at him. I think you can do it. They knelt down and prayed. And then he talked that doctor into delivering me that day in 1928 via cesarean. Tony, wow. T. Boone, it was 30 years later before they did another cesarean in that hospital. Tony, how incredible that your father had the courage not to accept what other people told him when it came to the life and death of those he loved. He had the courage to say there is another way and he wouldn't bend. That certainly has influenced your life, hasn't it, Boone? You don't take no for an answer, do you? T. Boone, no, I don't. Tony, well, your father is the ultimate role model of somebody who had the power to make a tough decision. You're here, and your mama lived as well. What a beautiful story. I now understand the reference to luckiest guy in the world. T. Boone, yep. Tony, you've also been deeply impacted by the concept of honesty, which for many people, unfortunately in the financial industry, isn't a core principle. Talk to me about that. T. Boone, Tony, I was on my paper route as a boy when I looked down and something caught my eye, and it was a billfold in the grass. And I recognized it as a neighbor's of someone on my paper route, so I knocked on the door of his house and I said, Mr. White, I found your billfold. And he said, oh my gosh, this is very important to me, thank you. I want to reward you. And he gave me a dollar, which I couldn't believe. I mean, a dollar was a lot of money back then. Tony, of course. T. Boone, it was 1940, I was 11 years old. Tony, wow. T. Boone, so I went home, and I was very happy, and I started to tell my mom and my aunt and my grandma my story, that Mr. White had given me a dollar. And they were all shaking their heads. I could tell they didn't like the story, and I said, don't you understand? He was happy that I found his billfold and took it to him. And my grandmother looked at me and said, son, you're not going to be rewarded for honesty. So it was decided for me to take the dollar back to Mr. White. Tony, that's awesome. So making tough decisions and honesty, those two values have really shaped you. I remember reading a quote from you that inspired me as a kid. I've always been fascinated by what makes someone a leader versus a follower. And you said you always lived your life on your own terms. And I think I remember you saying that the secret to leadership was being decisive. T. Boone, we tried to take over Gulf Oil in 1984, and I thought it was a very weak management team, and I said, these guys can't even pull the trigger. They just aim, 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 and they never fire. Tony, that's great, so you're able to fire more quickly. T. Boone, a lot of people get put in leadership positions, and it drives me crazy because they don't make decisions. They don't want to make decisions. They would like somebody to do it for them. I feel like the decisions I make will be good, and I'll see good results. Tony, well, that theory has certainly proven itself true. You became a billionaire by understanding energy and taking advantage of it. T-Boone, I'm 19 of 21 accurate predictions on oil prices. Tony, wow, 19 out of 21? T-Boone, on CNBC, yes. Tony, that's absolutely incredible. And you got $4 per gallon gasoline right, yes? No one thought it would go that high back in 2011. T-Boone, when I spoke at your event, Tony, back in 2011 in Sun Valley, I stuck my neck out and said we were going to see $120 a barrel by 4th of July weekend, which we did. I remember saying global demand was going to hit 90 billion barrels a day, and the price was going to have to go up to meet that level of demand. Tony, many of my platinum partners made a lot of money betting on that prediction, Boone. You gave them a synthetic option for taking advantage of that run-up. It was spot on, thank you. So given your track record, one of the themes I've seen over and over with many of the greatest investors has been a focus on asymmetric risk/reward. How do you think about reducing your risk or making sure it's worth the reward? What's your philosophy on that? T-Boone, you get an MBA, that's what they'll teach you. Cut your downside and give yourself a greater upside, and the payoff will come. I never approach investing that way. Tony, really? T-Boone, listen, some deals are better than others, and I think we do a good job analyzing risk. But I can't tell you specifically how I arrive at a decision. I know if I hit it, I'm going to knock it out of the park. And on the same one, maybe I strike out. I am willing to take big risks to make big rewards. Tony, okay, understood. So let me ask you this. If you couldn't pass on any of your financial wealth, but all you could pass on to your children was an investment philosophy or a portfolio strategy, what would it be? How would you encourage them so that they could have wealth long term? T-Boone, I really believe that if you've got a good work ethic, you probably pass it on. And if you have a good education to go along with a good work ethic, if you're willing to work hard, I believe you can get there. I think the good work ethic came to me from a small town in Oklahoma. I saw my grandmother and mother and father all work hard. I saw people all around me work hard. I saw those who got a good education make more money. Tony, it sounds like rather than teach them a portfolio, you want to teach them a mindset, a work ethic. T-Boone, that's right. Tony, you've made and lost billions. What is money to you? What is wealth? T-Boone, well, I can tell you when I knew I was wealthy. Tony, and when was that? T-Boone, when I had 12 bird dogs. Tony, and how old were you? T-Boone, I was 50. Tony, really? T-Boone, I was hunting one day. I'd always had bird dogs and I'd always been a quail hunter. My dad was and I was too. But I had one bird dog in the backyard, and when I did better, I had two. When I got 12 bird dogs, I had a kennel, and one day I said, you know, I'm a rich guy. I've got 12 bird dogs. Tony, and you've used that wealth to do so much good for this country. I know that you were one of the most generous university benefactors of all time, having given over $500 million to your alma mater, Oklahoma State University, which is absolutely incredible. T-Boone, my goal has always been to make OSU more competitive in athletics and academics. I am privileged to give to my alma mater. Tony, wasn't your 2005 gift to OSU athletics the single largest in NCAA history? T-Boone, that's correct. Tony, that's just amazing. And I know that's just part of your contribution and giving, which I so admire. Let's switch gears and let's talk about energy independence. You made your fortune in the oil industry. You're not the most likely candidate to be preaching oil independence for this country, and yet that's been your mission for the past 7 years. Tell me about the Pickens plan. T-Boone, here's the thing, Tony. America is addicted to oil, and that addiction threatens our economy, our environment, and our national security. It's been getting worse every decade. In 1970, we imported 24% of our oil. Today, it's nearly 70% and growing. Tony, wow, so you're trying to move us away from that. T-Boone, well, we've put our security in the hands of potentially unfriendly and unstable foreign nations. If we are depending on foreign sources for nearly 70% of our oil, We are in a precarious position in an unpredictable world. And over the next 10 years, the cost will be $10 trillion. It will be the greatest transfer of wealth in the history of mankind. Tony, that's incredible. So, what's the solution? T-Bone, we can make huge gains by upgrading to renewable sources of energy, but that doesn't solve our OPEC problem. OPEC actually has nothing to do with renewables. Wind and solar are not transportation fuels. That's where natural gas comes in. 70% of all the oil used every day in the world goes for transportation use. The only thing that we've got to take out OPEC is natural gas or our own oil. Tony, so what do? T-Bone, we import about 12 million barrels a day, 5 of which come from OPEC. We need to produce more natural gas here in the United States to get rid of the OPEC oil, and we have the resources to do it. Tony, we're sitting on a 100-year supply of natural gas here in America. We've got at least 4 trillion barrels of oil equivalent, BOE. That's 3 times the amount of the oil reserves that Saudi Arabia has. If we don't capitalize on that, we're going to go down as the dumbest crab that ever came to town. Tony, that's incredible. T-Bone, and natural gas is so cheap right now. $100 barrel of oil is equivalent to about $16 of natural gas. We've never seen $16 natural gas. Whether it's for trucking or power generation, anybody that uses energy today has to consider natural gas. Tony, I know you've spent a ton of your own time, energy, and money on the Pickens plan. You've taken your case to the American public and bankrolled a national campaign and media blitz. What do you think? Is it going to work? T-Bone, I launched this plan in Washington, D.C. in 2008, and I've spent $100 million of my own money on this. I feel like I've done everything I could on this, and yes, we're going to get an energy plan for America. Tony, I talk about asset allocation in this book. Virtually all of your assets are in energy. That's been most of your life, correct? T-Bone, that's right, but in energy you have lots of different sectors. We invest across the energy spectrum, but don't go beyond that. Tony, so that's your version of asset allocation. If you were an individual investor today and you had, let's say, $50,000 to invest, where would you put it? T-Bone, downstream, you have exploration companies and refineries and all. Most of my time has been spent upstream, on the exploring and producing side of the equation. But right now, natural gas is so cheap. It's very interesting. That's the place to be. Overall, I think the oil and gas industry has a fabulous future because of technology. The advancements we've made in technology have been unbelievable. Our country today looks a lot better from a standpoint of natural resources than we did 10 years ago. I didn't feel this way 10 years ago. I didn't feel near as confident as I do today. Tony, tell me what drives you, Boone. T-Bone, you know, Tony, what drives me at this point is that I like to make money. I like giving it away, not as much as making it, but it's a close second. I firmly believe that one of the reasons I was put here on this earth was to be successful, to make money, and be generous with it. Tony, be generous? T-Bone, one of my goals is to give away $1 billion before I die. You know Warren Buffett's and Bill Gates' giving pledge? They called me up and asked me to join, and I said, if you look at Fortune magazine in 1983, why don't you join my club, where I said I was going to give 90% away? Tony, that's spectacular. T-Bone, every day I go to the office and I look forward to going to the office. That's the way it has been throughout my life, and so my work is everything to me. But you say that, no, my family is everything to me. You can't say that. It's just all fun. When I'm with my family, it's fun. When I'm working, it's fun. The results aren't perfect, but they're good enough to make you think the next day is going to be a home run. They may not be, but I still think every day will be. Tony, you inspire me, like you inspire so many people around the world. I'm inspired by your passion and intensity. At 86, Boone, with so many extraordinary accomplishments, you just keep on growing and giving. T-Bone, thank you, Tony. You've been a successful man, too, and helped so many people. Probably helped a lot more than I have. Tony, oh, I don't know. T-Bone, but we're both winners because we do give. Tony, yes, I agree. I love you dearly, my friend. Thank you. Chapter 6.9. Kyle Bass, the Master of Risk. Founder, Heyman Capital Management. As a competitive diver, Kyle Bass understands the basic law of physics. He well knows that what goes up must come down. That's why in 2005 he began to ask questions about the booming U.S. housing market, questions no one else thought to ask, like, what happens if housing prices don't keep going up forever? Those questions led him to make one of the biggest bets in the world on the impending housing crash of 2008, and the economic meltdown that followed. That bet would earn him his first billion. Bass would go on to make a 600% return on his money in just 18 months and secure his place as one of the brightest, most thoughtful hedge fund managers of his time. Kyle does very few interviews, but it turned out my work had inspired him while he was still in college, so I had the privilege to fly out to Texas to sit down with him in his skyscraper building overlooking the great city of Dallas. Bass is one of the few financial powerhouses who views his distance from New York City as a competitive advantage. "We don't get bogged down by the noise," he says. Bass is humble and approachable. When I asked him about the questioning that led him to bet against the housing market, he replied, "Tony, this isn't rocket science. This is just some idiot from Dallas asking questions." Bass lives with his wife and two young children and serves on the board of trustees of the University of Texas Investment Management Company, helping to oversee one of the largest public endowments in the country with over $26 billion in assets. You've already learned about Bass and his nickels. He's the guy who taught his children the lesson of asymmetric risk-reward by buying up $1 million worth of nickels and earning a 25% return on day one of his investment. In fact, Bass says he'd put his entire net worth in nickels if he could find that many coins on the market to buy. Nickels aside, Bass's relentless focus on asymmetric risk-reward has led to two of the biggest return bets of the century, in both the housing market and the European debt crisis that began in 2008. And he's got a third bet underway that he says is even bigger. What follows is an excerpt from our 2.5-hour conversation in his downtown office. Tony Robbins, tell me a little about yourself. Kyle Bass, I was a springboard and platform diver, which people think is intensely physical, but it's 90% mental. It's basically you versus yourself. For me, it was very rewarding. It taught me how to be disciplined and how to learn from my failures. It's really how you deal with failure that defines you as a person. I have a loving mother and a loving father, but they never saved any money. I swore I would never be like that. My parents both smoked. I swore I would never smoke. For me, I've always been driven harder by the negative things in my life versus the positive. There are many congruencies in my life and your teachings. Tony, absolutely. When I look at the one common denominator that makes somebody succeed, beyond education or talent, it's hunger. Kyle, hunger and pain. Tony, the hunger comes from the pain. You don't get really hungry when it's been easy. Kyle, that's right. Tony, so your hunger drove you to start your own fund. It was 2006, right? Kyle, correct. Tony, the thing that's so amazing to me is the speed at which you started producing returns. Kyle, that was lucky. Tony, you had 20% the first year and like 216% the next year, right? Kyle, that's right. It was just fortuitous that early on I saw what was going on in the mortgage market. I believe in the saying, luck is where preparation meets opportunity. I think I might have read that in one of your books when I was in college. Well, I was prepared. I like to think that I was lucky and in the right place at the right time because I had all my resources dedicated to that in the moment. Tony, a lot of people knew about the housing problem and didn't act on it. What was different about you? What really made you succeed in that area? Kyle, if you remember back then, money was basically free. In 2005 and 2006, you could get a LIBOR plus 250 term loan, meaning a very cheap loan, and you and I could go buy any company we wanted with a little bit of equity and a ton of debt. I was on the phone with my friend and colleague, Alan Fournier, at the time, and we were trying to figure out how not to lose betting against housing. And the pundits kept saying housing is a product of job growth and income growth, so as long as you had income growth and job growth, home prices would keep going up. That, of course, was flawed thinking. Tony, Yes, as we all found out. Kyle, I had a meeting at the Federal Reserve in September of 2006, and they said, "Look, Kyle, you're new to this. You have to realize that income growth drives housing." And I said, "But wait, housing has moved in perfect tandem with median income for 50 years. But in the last 4 years, housing has gone up 8% a year and incomes have only moved 1.5%. So we're 5 or 6 standard deviations from the mean. To bring those relationships back in line again, incomes would have to go up almost 35%, or housing had to drop 30%. So I called around all the desks on Wall Street and I said, "I want to see your model. Show me what happens if home prices only go up 4% a year, 2% a year, or 0%. There wasn't one Wall Street firm, not one, in June of 2006 that had a model that contemplated housing being flat. Tony, are you serious? Kyle, not one. Tony, these guys just drank their own Kool-Aid. Kyle, so, in November of 2006, I asked UBS to put forth a model that had flat home prices, and their model said that losses to the mortgage pool would be 9%. A mortgage pool is a group of mortgages with similar maturities and interest rates that were lumped together into a single package or security called a mortgage-backed security. These securities were assigned a high credit rating and then sold to investors for an expected return. Assuming housing prices continued to go up, the pool would deliver high returns. But if home prices didn't go up, if they just sat still, these things were going to lose 9%. I called Alan Fournier of Pennant Capital Management. He formerly worked for David Tepper's Appaloosa Management. And I said, "This is it." And when I formed the general partner of my subprime funds, I named it AFGP after Alan Fournier because of the phone call we had. Because for me, that phone call flipped the switch. Tony, wow. And can you tell me what the risk-reward ratio of that bet for you and Alan was? Kyle, basically I could bet against housing and only pay 3% a year. If I bet $1 and home prices went up, all I could lose was 3 cents. Tony, amazing. So the risk, the price to bet against housing, was totally out of whack. Kyle, yep, it only cost me 3%. Tony, because everyone thought the market would go up forever. And the upside? Kyle, if housing stayed flat or went down, I'd make the whole dollar. Tony, so 3% downside if you were wrong, 100% upside if you were right. Kyle, yes, and it's a good thing I didn't listen to every mortgage expert I met with. They all said, "Kyle, you have no idea what you're talking about. This isn't your market. This can't happen." I said, "Okay, well, that's not a good enough reason for me because I've done a lot of work on this and I may not understand everything you understand, but I could see the forest from the trees. And the people that live in that market, all they could see were the trees." Tony, you understood the core of risk/reward. Kyle, I also heard this a lot. "Well, that can't happen because the whole financial system would crash." That still wasn't good enough for me either. That bias, the positive bias that we all have, is built in. It's innate in human nature. You wouldn't get out of bed if you weren't positive about your life, right? It's a bias we have as humans to be optimistic. Tony, it works for us everywhere but in the financial world. Kyle, that's exactly right. Tony, what's even more amazing is that after calling the housing bust, you were also right about Europe and Greece. How did you do that? Again, I'm trying to understand the psychology of how you think. Kyle, in mid-2008, post-Bear Stearns, right before Lehman went bankrupt, we sat in here with my team and said, "Okay, what's going on throughout this crisis is that the risk in the world that used to be on private balance sheets is moving to the public balance sheets. So let's get a whiteboard and let's reconstruct the public government balance sheets of the nations. Let's look at Europe, let's look at Japan, let's look at the United States. Let's look everywhere there's a lot of debt and let's try to understand." So I thought, if I'm Ben Bernanke, head of the Fed at the time, or Jean-Claude Trichet, president of the European Central Bank, and I want to get my arms around this problem, what do I do? How do I do it? Well, here's what I'd do. I'd look at my own balance sheet debts as a country, and then I need to know how big my banking system is in relation to two things: my GDP, gross domestic product, and to my government revenue. Tony, Makes sense. Kyle, so we basically looked at a bunch of different countries and asked, how big is the banking system? How many loans are out there? Then we tried to figure out how many of them were going to go bad, and then back solved for how bad it was going to be for us as a country. So I told my team to go call some firms and find out how big those countries' banking systems were. Guess how many firms had a handle on that mid-2008? Tony, how many? Kyle, zero, not one, and we called everybody. Tony, wow. Kyle, so I dug into the white papers on sovereign country debt and read them all. They are mostly focused on emerging economies because historically, it was emerging nations that restructured their sovereign balance sheets. Tony, developed nations only restructured post-war. Kyle, right. Two countries spend a fortune to go to war. They run up debts, and to the victor goes the spoils, and to the loser went defeat every time. That's how the world works. In this case, it was the largest accumulation of debt in peacetime in world history. Tony, amazing. Kyle, so how big is the banking system? We went out there and gathered the data and used two denominators, GDP and central government tax revenue. And this was a huge learning process because we had never done it before. Tony, it sounds like nobody else had. Kyle, this isn't rocket science, Tony. This is some idiot in Dallas saying, how do I get my arms around the problem? And so we did the work and I came up with charts and I said, rank them worst to best. Who is the single worst entry on that sheet? Tony, Iceland? Kyle, right, Iceland went first. Who was next? It wasn't rocket science. Tony, Greece. Kyle nods yes. Wow. Kyle, so we did all this work, and I looked at the analysis and I said, this can't be right. I was being hyperbolic to my team. I was saying, if this is right, you know what's going to happen next. Tony, correct. Kyle, so then I asked, where are the insurance contracts trading on Ireland and Greece? And my team said, Greece is 11 basis points. 11 basis points. That's 11 hundredths of 1%. And I said, well, we need to go buy a billion of that one. Tony, wow, that's incredible. Kyle, mind you, this is third quarter 2008. Tony, the writing was on the wall at that stage. Kyle, I called Professor Kenneth Rogoff at Harvard University, who didn't know me from Adam, and I said, I've spent several months constructing a world balance sheet and trying to understand this. I said, the results of our construct, they're too negative for me. I literally said, I think I must be misinterpreting these. Could I come sit down and share with you the results of my work? And he said, by all means. Tony, that's great. Kyle, so I spent 2.5 hours with him in February of 2009. And I'll never forget, he got to the summary page with a chart of all the data, and he sat back in his chair, put his glasses up, and said, Kyle, I can hardly believe it's this bad. And I'm immediately thinking, oh shit, all of my fears are being confirmed by the father of sovereign balance sheet analysis. So if he wasn't thinking about it, do you think Bernanke and Trichet were? No one was thinking about this. There was no cohesive plan. Tony, none? Kyle, he was dealing with curveballs as they were being thrown. Tony, that's just unbelievable. So I have to ask you about Japan because I know that's where you're focused on now. Kyle, right now the biggest opportunity in the world is in Japan and it's way better than subprime was. The timing is less certain, but the payoff is multiples of what the subprime market was. I believe the world's stress point is Japan. And it's about the cheapest it's ever been right now, meaning to buy a kind of insurance policy. Tony, yes, and what is it costing you? Kyle, well, the two things to take into account for the options pricing model are, one, the risk-free rate, and two, the volatility of the underlying asset. So imagine if the turkey used this theory. If he were gauging his risk of being killed based upon the historical volatility of his life, it would be zero risk. Tony, right. Kyle, until Thanksgiving Day. Tony, until it's too late. Kyle, when you think about Japan, there's been 10 years of suppressed prices and subdued volatility. The volatility is mid-single digits. It's as low as any asset class in the world. The risk-free rate is 1/10 of 1%. So when you ask the price on an option, the formula basically tells you it should be free. Tony: Right. Kyle: So if the Japanese bonds move up 150 basis points to 200 basis points, 1.5 to 2%, it's over. The whole system detonates, in my opinion. Tony: Wow. Kyle: But my theory is, I have always said to our investors, if it moves 200 basis points, it's going to move 1,500. Tony: Right. Kyle: It's either going to sit still and do nothing, or it's going to blow apart. Tony: This all plays into your idea of tail risk. Tell me what tail risk is. Not many investors focus on it. Kyle: If you look at what I'm doing, I'm spending 3 or 4 basis points per year on Japan. That's 0.004%, okay? If I'm right about the binary nature of the potential outcome of the situation there, these bonds are going to trade at 20% yields or higher. So I'm paying 0.004% for an option that could be worth 2,000%. Tony, there has never been a more mispriced option that's existed in world history. Now, that's my opinion. I could be wrong. So far I am, by the way. Tony: You're wrong on timing. Kyle: I'll tell you what, I can be wrong for 10 years, and if I'm right 10 years from now, it was still 100% odds on that to be there before it happened. And people say to me, how can you bet on that? Because it's never happened before. And I say, well, how can you be a prudent fiduciary if I give you the scenario I just laid out and not do this? Forget whether you think I'm right or wrong. When I show you the cost, how do you not do that? If your home is in an area that is prone to fire and 200 years ago there was a big fire that wiped everything out, how do you not pay for homeowners insurance? Tony: Got it. That's awesome. So let me ask you this. Do you consider yourself to be a significant risk taker? Kyle: No. Tony: I didn't think so. That's why I asked. Why do you say you're not a risk taker? Kyle: Let me rephrase that. Significant risk taker means we can lose all of our money. I never set myself up for the knockout punch. Tony: Tell me this. If you could not pass on any of your money to your children, you can only pass on a portfolio and a set of rules, what would that look like for your kids? Kyle: I'd give them a couple $100 million worth of nickels, because then they wouldn't have to worry about anything. Tony: They're done. Their investment portfolio is done. Oh my God, that's wild. What gives you the most joy in life? Kyle: I have my kids. Tony: That's awesome. Kyle: 100%. Tony: Kyle, thank you. I so enjoyed this and I learned a lot. Chapter 6.10. Mark Faber, the billionaire they call Dr. Doom. Director of Mark Faber Limited, publisher of Gloom, Boom, and Doom Report. The fact that Mark Faber's investment newsletter is called the Gloom, Boom, and Doom Report should give you a hint about his outlook on markets. But this Swiss billionaire isn't your average bear. Mark, who's been a friend of mine for many years, is a colorful, outspoken contrarian who follows the advice of the 18th century investor Baron Rothschild. The best time to buy is when there's blood in the streets. And like Sir John Templeton, he hunts for bargains that everybody else ignores or avoids. That's why, while so many are focused on the U.S. stock market, Mark Faber looks almost exclusively to Asia for his growth investments. He's also a blunt critic of all central banks, particularly the U.S. Federal Reserve, which he blames for destabilizing the world's economy by flooding it with trillions of dollars virtually printed out of thin air. Mark has earned the nickname Dr. Doom by continually predicting that the most popular assets are overpriced and headed for collapse. As the Sunday Times of London wrote, Mark Faber says the things nobody wants to hear. But he's often been right, especially in 1987 when he made a huge fortune anticipating the U.S. stock market crash. Faber's father was an orthopedic surgeon and his mother came from a family of Swiss hoteliers. He earned a Ph.D. in economics at the University of Zurich and started his financial career with the global investment firm White Weld & Company. By 1973, he transferred to Asia and never looked back. From his office in Hong Kong and his villa in Chiang Mai, Thailand, Mark has had a front row seat to the incredible transformation of China from a communist quagmire to the growth engine that drives the whole region. He's now considered one of the leading experts in Asian markets. Mark, known for his eccentricity, gleefully acknowledges his reputation as a connoisseur of the world's nightlife and is a popular speaker at financial forums and on cable news shows. He's a member of the prestigious Barron's Roundtable, where, according to independent observers, his recommendations have had the highest return, almost 23% per annum, for 12 years in a row. Mark is also the author of several books on Asia and the director of Mark Faber Limited, a Hong Kong-based advisory and investment fund. Mark speaks English with a gravelly Swiss accent and never takes himself too seriously. Here's an excerpt from my on-stage interview with him at my Sun Valley Economic Conference in 2014. Tony Robbins, what would you say are the three biggest investment lies that are still promoted in the world today? Mark Faber, well, I think everything is a lie. It's always very simple, but I mean, look, I've met a lot of very honest people and so forth, but unfortunately in your lifetime, you will come across more salesman-type financial advisors. You should really have people that are very honest. But I can tell you this from experience. Everybody will always sell your dream investments, and my experience has been, being the chairman of many different investment funds, usually the clients make very little money. But the managers of the fund and the promoters, they all walk away with a lot of money. All of them. Tony, where should investors turn? Mark, there are different theories in the investment world. They're essentially the efficient market theory proponents. They say that markets are efficient. In other words, when you invest, the best is just to buy an index. And the individual selection of securities is basically useless. But I can tell you I know many fund managers that have actually significantly outperformed over time the market significantly. I believe that some people have some skills at analyzing companies because they're either good accountants or they have skills. Tony, what do you think of the markets these days? Mark, I think there's still risk in the emerging world, and it's still too early to buy their currencies and stocks, and it's too late to buy the U.S. I don't want to buy the S&P index after it reaches 1800. I don't see any value, so best is to go drinking and dancing and do nothing. You understand? It was Jesse Livermore, a famous early 20th century trader, who said, "The most money is made by doing nothing, sitting tight. Sitting tight means you have cash." In your life, the important thing is not to lose money. If you don't see really good opportunities, why take big risks? Some great opportunities will occur every 3 or 4 or 5 years, and then you want to have money. There was a huge opportunity in U.S. housing prices at the end of 2011. Actually, I wrote about this. I went to Atlanta to look at homes and then Phoenix. I don't want to live there, but there was an opportunity. But the opportunity closed very quickly, and the individuals were at the disadvantage because the hedge funds came in with cash. The private equity guys, they just bought thousands of homes away. Tony, do you see deflation coming or inflation coming? Mark, the inflation/deflation debate is misplaced in my view in the sense that inflation should be defined as an increase in the quantity of money. If the money in circulation increases, as a result, credit increases. We have monetary inflation. This is the important point. Monetary inflation. Then we have the symptoms of this monetary inflation, and these symptoms can be very diverse. It can be an increase in consumer prices. It can be an increase in wages. But again, it's not as simple as that, because in the U.S., we have in many sectors actually a decline in wages in real terms over the last 20 or 30 years already, inflation adjusted. But what about the wages in Vietnam and in China? In China, wages have been going up at the rate of something like 20% or 25% per annum, and elsewhere also in emerging economies. So to answer your question, in a system, we can have deflation in certain things and assets and goods and prices and even services, and inflation in others. It's very seldom that in the world everything will go up in price at the same rate or everything will collapse in price at the same rate. Usually if you especially have a fiat currency system, those who can print money, then what you will have is the money doesn't really disappear. It just goes into something else. What can disappear is credit. That's why you could have an overall price level that would be declining. But for us investors, we essentially want to know which prices will go up. Like, is the price of oil going to go up or down? Because if it goes up, then maybe I want to own some oil shares. and if it goes down, I may want to own something else. Tony, what would you suggest would be the asset allocation to take advantage of the environment we're in right now and to protect yourself? Mark, well, my asset allocation used to be 25% shares stocks, 25% gold, 25% cash and bonds, and 25% real estate. Now I have reduced my stock positions as a percentage of the total assets. I have more cash.